Well, I'm sure it's a question that you've all asked at some point. Why must the story of the gingerbread man have such a sad ending? I mean, for the most part, it's such a great story, isn't it? The gingerbread man escaping from the baker's oven and taunting all those motley characters that are chasing him across the countryside. What a shame that he finally gets gobbled up by the sly fox. If only the story could have ended before that fateful river crossing. And it's a bit like that then with the story of the two blind men in the first part of our passage this morning. For the most part, it's a great story. These men, first of all, crying out to Jesus, appealing to his merciful character and appealing to his messianic identity. And then after that, demonstrating such tenacity in following Jesus into that house when others might have given up. And then after that, expressing their confidence in his healing power with that emphatic, "Yes, Lord." So throughout verses 27 and 28, it's all very heartwarming stuff. And you think, if only the story could have ended there. But it doesn't end there. It continues with three more verses. And the change of mood in those verses might not be quite as conspicuous as in the final scene of the gingerbread man, but it's real, and it comes across in at least three ways. First of all, a strange phrase. Verse 29, Jesus says to them, "According to your faith be it done to you." According to your faith. Is he actually commending their faith there? I mean, it's kind of open to interpretation, isn't it? That might be an easy assumption to make when you're reading the passage quickly, that he's commending their faith. But when you think about those words, according to your faith, is he actually commending it? Certainly it lacks the warmth of verse 22. "Take heart, daughter, your faith has made you well." It lacks the warmth of chapter 8, verse 10, when Jesus heard this, he marveled and said to those who followed him, "Truly, I tell you, with no one in Israel have I found such faith." Nor is there an accompanying comment here from Matthew, like the one that he gives us in verse 2 of this chapter, when Jesus saw their faith, ... There's nothing like that here. It's very matter of fact, isn't it? You're exercising some faith, and so you're going to receive something commensurate with that faith that you're exercising. That's all that Jesus says. It's a strange phrase. But then a second way this change of mood comes across, a strong emotion. Verse 30 then, that second sentence in the verse, "Jesus sternly warned them," is how the first half of that sentence goes in our ESV. It's not a great translation. It sounds as though Matthew is merely talking about the way in which Jesus issued this secrecy command. He did it sternly. He did it the way that Captain Mannering barked out orders to his platoon in Dad's army. But actually, in that first half of the sentence, Matthew hasn't come yet to the command, has he? He's not interested in the command yet. He's interested in Jesus' emotional state. And he uses a word here that John uses in John chapter 11, the Lazarus narrative. In John 11, both in verse 33 and in verse 38, it says in our versions that Jesus was deeply moved. But many of you have heard me say often before that John is really talking about anger there. He's really talking about anger. Jesus in Bethany was angry. And similarly here then, the same word, Jesus is angry. Benjamin Warfield, he translates this verse in this way: Jesus raged against them, saying, "See that no one knows about it." Now, Warfield thinks that Jesus' anger here is caused by pretty much the same thing as in John 11. So there, it's his encounter with death, and particularly his awareness of the one who stands behind death, the devil, that makes him angry. And here then, it's his encounter with this horrible physical condition, blindness, and his awareness of the one who stands behind that and all other horrible physical conditions, the devil, that makes him angry. That's Warfield's opinion of our text. But while I think he's right about John 11, and remember the other week I interpreted Jesus' rebuke to the winds and the seas back in chapter 8 in that way, I said that he's angry there with the one who stands behind that raging storm, the devil. Well, I think that's the right way to understand Jesus' anger in some of these miracle passages. I don't think that interpretation fits our text this morning. For one thing, by the time Jesus is angry here, the blindness is already gone. The healing is done and dusted. The eyes have been opened. There's no need for Jesus to be angry about this horrible physical condition anymore because their blindness isn't there now. For another thing, Matthew says explicitly that this anger was against them. That is, against the blind men. It wasn't against the blindness and against the one who stands behind the blindness. It was against the men themselves. And for another thing, the anger does seem to be related in some way to this command that Jesus is about to issue. Now, we'll come back to Jesus' anger here, but my point just now is that this strong emotion, it's another indication then that this story does not have a happy ending. Rather, we're very much here in gingerbread man territory. So a strange phrase, a strong emotion, and then a third thing, a stark word. A stark word. So verse 30 has ended with this command from Jesus, see that no one knows about it. And verse 31 then begins, but. But. Now that's not a word that should ever follow a command from Jesus Christ, is it? But. I mean, remember chapter 7, verse 26. Everyone who hears these words of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand. Well, these two men hear this word of Christ's. They don't do that word, however. Instead, we're given by Matthew this very jarring word, this very chilling word, this very stark word, but. But. And I hope you can see then that verses 29 to 31 are really quite troubling in these different ways. But I suppose we could feel, oh well, we won't worry too much about those verses. On balance, we can still evaluate these two men positively. We can commend their faith because whatever else may be said about them, it's very clear in verses 27 and 28 that they believe in Jesus' ability to heal blindness. That means they believe that Jesus is someone very great indeed. And surely that has to be the decisive consideration here. That's the determining factor in how we should regard them. A faith in Jesus that consists in recognizing his greatness, that has to count for something. That has to be the real deal. It has to be true, valid faith. We could feel like that, but I want to ask, is that really a biblical perspective? Does the Bible indicate that the kind of faith in Jesus that recognizes who he is and recognizes his power and his uniqueness and his greatness, does the Bible indicate that that kind of faith is always true and valid and real faith? What about those demons that James famously mentions? In James chapter 2, verse 19, even the demons believe, James says. They have that kind of faith that recognizes the greatness of Jesus. I mean, we've seen it recently in Matthew's gospel, haven't we? What have you to do with us, O Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time? Chapter 8, verse 29. Those demons in chapter 8, they take Jesus seriously, all right. They don't dismiss him as some little Galilean itinerant preacher of no consequence. They have a high view of his authority and of his role. But it isn't a proper living faith, is it? We wouldn't embrace those demons as fellow believers this morning, would we? We wouldn't admit them into membership of NREC and invite them to the Lord's table with us. I'm saying faith can be invalid even where it's not atheistic and it's not skeptical and it doesn't take the 20th century liberal view of Jesus that he was a good man and a noble spirit and nothing more than that. Now, this faith I'm talking about, it might not scorn Jesus' miracles. It might not refute Jesus' claims. It might not deny Jesus' supernaturalism. And yet it's still invalid. The Bible holds out that possibility. And it seems to me that that's where these two blind men are. That's their situation. They have a faith that recognizes the greatness of Jesus. That's unmistakable in verses 27 and 28. And yet it is invalid. And that, I would suggest, puts them in the same category as another group of people in our passage, in the second half of our passage that I haven't yet touched upon. I'm talking about the Pharisees. And notice then, these Pharisees in verses 32 to 34, they take Jesus' miraculous powers just as seriously as the blind men do. They don't solicit a miracle like the blind men did, but they do observe a miracle. They observe this exorcism that enables a formerly mute man to suddenly speak. And their reaction to it is fascinating. Look at the first four words that they say. He casts out demons. That's what they say. He casts out demons. They don't say, this man that has just had this thing done to him by Jesus, he wasn't really as bad as he seemed to be. He just had a nasty sore throat. And, Jesus sneaked him a strepsil and that did the trick. And there wasn't really any muteness and there wasn't really any demon and there wasn't really any exorcism, therefore. They're not saying that. They acknowledge they've just witnessed something miraculous. They acknowledge Jesus' extraordinary capabilities. He casts out demons, they say. But then they add those tragic, blasphemous five words, by the prince of demons. They have a faith in Jesus that recognizes his power, his uniqueness, his greatness, and yet that faith is invalid. And I'm saying then that in the last analysis, the blind men in the first part of our passage and the Pharisees in the second part of our passage, they're really both in that same category. And what I want to do then, just in the rest of our time this morning, is explore further this invalid faith that I'm saying is on display in our passage. What is wrong with it exactly? What are its fatal flaws that render it invalid? That's the kind of question I want us to consider. And my answer then is something like this. This faith that's on display in our passage this morning, it's invalid because although, yes, it recognizes the greatness of Jesus, at the same time, there are several things about Jesus that it cannot tolerate. There are several things about Jesus that it really doesn't like. So let's look briefly at three things that this invalid faith doesn't like about Jesus. First of all, it doesn't like Jesus claiming the lordship. It doesn't like Jesus claiming the lordship. And I'm thinking here then of that stark word, as I called it, that word "but" there in verse 31, signaling the fact that these two men brazenly defied the command that they received from Jesus. You see, Jesus makes two authoritative utterances in this little story. The first is in verse 29, and it doesn't come across brilliantly in the ESV. The New King James captures it best, according to your faith, let it be to you. Let it be, rather than be it done, let it be to you. And let it be, I think, conveys this authoritative dimension better than simply be it done. And importantly indeed, it conveys the echo that we have here of one of the Bible's most iconic passages, Genesis chapter 1. Let there be light. Let there be an expanse in the midst of the waters. Let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens. Our Greek text here has exactly the same word on the lips of Jesus as the Greek text of Genesis 1. Let there be. And so Jesus here, let it be. The same language, exactly. So that's how authoritative this utterance of Jesus in verse 29 is. As God once commanded light to replace darkness, Jesus here commands sight to replace blindness. As God's powerful word once moved the waters, some going upwards to the heavens, some going downwards to the seas, Jesus' powerful word here moves the impairment from these men's eyes. So that's the first authoritative utterance there in verse 29. And the second, of course, is in verse 30. See that no one knows about it. See that no one knows what I have just done for you. So two authoritative utterances. But this is the thing. These two men want the first, but they don't want the second. They like Jesus dispelling their blindness. They don't like Jesus dictating their behavior. They fancy Jesus claiming the lordship of their eye condition. They don't fancy Jesus claiming the lordship of their entire conduct. They're into Jesus' word insofar as it benefits them and means deliverance. They're not into Jesus' word when it binds them and makes demands. That's the situation of these two men. And I'm saying that that's not true faith. Fraser loves meat. In fact, when it comes to savory food, he doesn't really like much else other than meat. And so when we have chili for dinner, he will try to pick out the meat while leaving behind the onions and the beans and everything else that's in there. Well, true faith doesn't do that with Jesus. It doesn't pick out Jesus' saviorhood and leave behind his lordship. It doesn't pick out what Jesus offers and leave behind what Jesus requires. No, true faith embraces the whole Jesus. And not, by the way, merely out of a sense of propriety. The way that we adults might eat all the chili on our plate, even though we'd actually prefer to leave the onions and beans behind as well, but we think it's proper and it's appropriate that we do this. No, true faith recognizes that in the last analysis, the distinction actually between what Jesus offers and what Jesus requires is a false distinction. What Jesus requires is actually part of what Jesus offers, because his lordship is not this confining, restricting thing. He's the best possible master whose intentions for his servants are always only good. His is an elevating, ennobling lordship. There's no healthier, happier, freer state of existence than to be under the mastery of Jesus Christ. And so true faith says, take my life and let it be consecrated, Lord, to thee. True faith says, King of my life, I crown thee now. True faith says, Jesus, I'm not my own. I am yours. Every part of me is yours. All that I am is under your absolute rule. Jesus, have the lordship of my life. This invalid faith, on the other hand, the faith of these two men, it doesn't like Jesus claiming the lordship. Then a second thing about this invalid faith. It doesn't like Jesus claiming the lordship, but also it doesn't like Jesus rescuing the lost. It doesn't like Jesus rescuing the lost. So we talked briefly earlier about this strong emotion to which Matthew testifies in Jesus in verse 30. I guess it's the hardest part of the passage to get our heads around once we've appreciated what a strong emotion Matthew is describing. And I said then that Jesus was angry with them in this case. In this case, not angry with the curse, not angry with the devil who lies behind the curse, but angry with the men themselves. And so, of course, we need to ask the question, well, why was that? And I said then that it must have something to do with the command that immediately ensues. See that no one knows about it. Perhaps an Old Testament analogy is helpful here. We talked a few weeks ago at Time Out about an incident in the life of Elisha, when Elisha is in a conversation with a Syrian civil servant called Hazael. Some of you will know the passage. As he's talking to Hazael, Elisha suddenly out of the blue starts weeping. Why does he start weeping? There's nothing in the conversation itself that explains it. Well, it turns out the reason for Elisha's strong emotion there is that presumably by the Spirit's enabling, he foresees what is going to happen in the near future. And he foresees that this guy Hazael, presently a civil servant, is soon going to become king of Syria. And as king of Syria, he's going to wage the most brutal wars against Elisha's own nation, against Israel, and commit all kinds of atrocities against the people of God. And I think here, similarly then, the reason for Jesus' strong emotion is that presumably by the Spirit's enabling, he foresees what is going to happen in the near future. And he foresees that this command that he's giving to these men is going to be broken. And they are going to go and, as verse 31 says, spread his fame through all that district. But of course, that only then raises a further question. Well, what's the big deal about this silence issue? Why is it a bad thing that they're spreading his fame throughout the whole district? Why is he so intent on them being secret about this? After all, it isn't always portrayed as a bad thing in the Gospels when those who have encountered Jesus go away and tell others about it. When the Samaritan woman in John 4 goes back to her city and says, come see a man who told me everything I ever did, that's not presented in negative terms. She's presented as a kind of evangelist to her community. Or in Mark's account of the one demoniac being healed by Jesus, being exorcised, Jesus himself tells him he wants to come with Jesus back across the Sea of Galilee. Jesus says, no, go back and tell people everything that the Lord has done for you. So why then this command to secrecy here, and why does Jesus get so angry as he foresees that command being broken? Well, presumably the woman's report in John chapter 4 was a faithful report of the Jesus she had encountered and what he was all about. And presumably the demoniac's report, as he went back to the Decapolis and spoke of Jesus, that was a faithful report. Not a comprehensive report, because they couldn't possibly have had the data for that, but it was a faithful report of the Jesus that he had encountered. The blind men's reports of Jesus as they went through the district, presumably it wasn't faithful. How wasn't it? What were they saying about Jesus? Well, probably they were saying something like this. This man, Jesus, he's a miracle worker who specializes in removing people's trials and afflictions. If you've got some problem in your life that's making your life hard, then come to him. Just like we had this problem of our blind eyes, and so we went to him, and he healed that, he fixed it, he sorted it out, and he sent us on our way. You can go to him and he'll improve your health. or he'll deal with your finances, or he'll make your family situation much better, and he will help you then to have a better, smoother life for the rest of your days on earth. They were saying that kind of thing, most probably. In other words, something unrecognizable from that great mission statement to which I keep taking you back in chapter 1, verse 21, the angel's message to Joseph. What was Jesus going to be all about? He will save his people from their sins. Really, the rest of Matthew's gospel is footnotes to that one statement. He will save his people from their sins. They were proclaiming something unrecognizable from that. Or to put it another way, they were proclaiming a message about Jesus that had no place for the cross. Now, as I hinted a moment ago, you wouldn't expect them, of course, to be proclaiming the cross, because the cross hasn't happened yet and they don't know about the cross. But I'm saying their message wouldn't even leave any space, any logical space for the cross. It would leave the cross as something utterly unfitting and weird and unnecessary. They had no sense of Jesus coming to rescue the lost. It was all about him as a life enhancer. That I think is why we have that strange phrase I commented on in verse 29. According to your faith, be it done to you. I don't think he is commending their faith. He's recognizing there is a faith there. And I think he's saying, you have a faith that I can heal blindness. That's what you want. You want me to fix your problem. And so according to your faith, I'll work in you. And I'll fix that problem. Nothing more than that. Not the faith of the man at the beginning of the chapter, who we said comes to Jesus with a guilty conscience. And Jesus doesn't take him by surprise by saying, son, take heart, your sins are forgiven. That's precisely what he came to Jesus for. He didn't come for his paralysis. He came for his sins to be forgiven. And he got his sins forgiven. And Jesus says to these guys, according to your faith, you want a bit of healing, I'll give you a bit of healing. That, I think, is the point of verse 29. And so I'm saying this is why Jesus wants them to be silent. And this is why Jesus is angry when he foresees them not being silent. And it's why, again then, I'm saying this is not true faith. Because true faith doesn't go to Jesus to be helped in some compartment or other of my life. True faith doesn't go to Jesus so that Jesus will simply make me a better husband or a better boss at work or a more efficient person in fulfilling my daily routines. True faith doesn't go to Jesus to get a more purpose-driven life from Jesus. True faith doesn't want Jesus to simply tinker with something about me and then send me on my way, basically the same person that I was to start with. No, true faith says in the words of the hymn we sang, Jesus, I will trust thee with my soul, guilty, lost, and helpless. Thou canst make me whole. True faith says, Jesus, I'm lost. I need rescuing. I don't need help. I don't need enhancement. I don't need something that's useful. I need something altogether comprehensive. I'm a hellbound child of wrath under the power of the devil, and I need rescuing. I need a cross. I need a death. I need blood. I need a bloody sacrifice on a hill outside Jerusalem. Nothing else will do me any good. Nothing else will suffice. That's what I need, Jesus. That's what true faith says to him. This invalid faith, on the other hand, it doesn't like Jesus rescuing the lost. So it doesn't like Jesus claiming the lordship. It doesn't like Jesus rescuing the lost. But then, one more thing. This invalid faith, it doesn't like Jesus occupying the limelight. It doesn't like Jesus occupying the limelight. And here then we move to the Pharisees. And we've already seen then that they, like the blind men, they have a faith that recognizes the greatness of Jesus. He does cast out demons. But it's this invalid faith. And I think we need to ask the question, what precisely here prompts the Pharisees saying what they say? What prompts them attributing Jesus' exorcising ministry to demonic influence within him? It doesn't seem to be the exorcism itself that Jesus has performed, or at least not just that. Because Matthew tells us something else, doesn't he, between the exorcism and the Pharisees making their remark. And this is what he tells us in the last part of verse 33. The crowds marveled, saying, "Never was anything like this seen in Israel." And that then seems to be the catalyst. That's what prompts the Pharisees to say what they say. I think this is jealousy on their part. They're seeing Jesus occupying the limelight. They're seeing people, a crowd there in Capernaum, praising Jesus for what he's just done. And that hits a raw nerve within them. These are men who are used themselves to having the limelight. That's clear, isn't it? It's assumed throughout the Sermon on the Mount. Remember that whenever then Jesus is saying, you have heard, but I say to you, remember I kept emphasizing, he's not there contrasting his position with the Old Testament's position. He's not saying, you have heard in the scriptures, but I say to you. He's saying, you have heard from the scribes and Pharisees who appear early on, perhaps verse 20-ish of chapter 5. You've heard from them, ... Well, I'm saying to you. In other words, these scribes and Pharisees were influential men in first century Jewish society. They were men who were listened to. Their opinions were counted. They occupied the limelight. And here now we have this bunch of Pharisees, and they're standing there, and no one's looking at them, and no one's saying, aren't the Pharisees a great bunch of guys? But everyone's saying, wow, Jesus. And they bristle. And they react to that. And so, yes, they have a faith that recognizes Jesus' greatness and doesn't explain away exorcisms as silly deceptions. But it's a faith that doesn't like Jesus occupying the limelight. And again, I'm saying to you this morning, that's not true faith. True faith says, may Jesus Christ be praised. True faith is exemplified in the Apostle Paul when he's in prison. And there are men going around using the opportunity that that circumstance has given them to run Paul down. And they're going around the churches and saying, and they're preaching the scriptures, preaching Christ, but they're also running Paul down. And Paul can't defend himself because he's stuck in jail. And there's Paul in jail and he's all frustrated and agitated about this. No, he's not. Paul in jail writes to the Philippians in Philippians chapter 1, oh well, if Christ is being preached, I rejoice. That's all he cares about. He doesn't care what it's doing to him and how his reputation is being dragged through the hedge. All he cares about is that these rotten men with selfish motives, he says, selfish ambition in their hearts, he says, at least there's a bit of Christ coming through in what they say, and if there's a bit of Christ coming through, then I will rejoice, because all I care about is Jesus Christ occupying the limelight. It's the attitude exemplified, of course, in John the Baptist as well, isn't it? In a very similar situation to the Pharisees, a man who had been accustomed himself to occupying the limelight, hundreds of thousands, scholars estimate, went out to listen to John the Baptist there in the wilderness. He was a man in the limelight, all right. He was the one they all wanted to hear speak. And then Jesus comes along. And John has to step back. And he gets all angry and frustrated. No, he doesn't. I must decrease. He must increase. That's true faith. This faith of the Pharisees, on the other hand, that doesn't like Jesus in the limelight, that finds that irritating and niggling, that is an invalid faith. So we've seen then these three features of this invalid faith, I'm saying, is common to these two groups of people in our passage. These three things this faith doesn't like. It's a faith that recognizes something of Jesus' identity and his greatness, but it's a faith that doesn't like Jesus claiming the lordship or rescuing the lost or occupying the limelight. And my goal then this morning is not to make you all go home thinking, oh, I'm not sure anymore, I'm a believer. I'm not wanting to unsettle tender consciences that may easily be unsettled. There may be someone in here this morning, and you have a certain connection with Christianity and a certain connection with Jesus and a certain respect for him, and you go along with a lot of what the Bible says, and you think that that is real faith, and perhaps you do need to apply very searchingly these three criteria that I've talked about this morning. And perhaps you do need to ask some serious questions. Is my faith, in fact, more like the people in this passage than like that expressed in the hymns we've sung this morning? And that expressed by Paul in Philippians 1 and John the Baptist and so on. But for most of us, I guess, the purpose of us looking at all this morning is really just to turn these three headings on their heads, turn them upside down, and just make sure then that we are cultivating a faith that does say to Jesus, be the Lord of my life, King of my life, I crown thee now. That we're growing in that giving over of everything we are to the Lordship of Jesus. And to make sure we are cultivating a sense of our need of rescue by Jesus through his cross. Cultivating a sense of utter dependence on a Savior who had to die for us on a cross outside Jerusalem. And to make sure that we're cultivating a desire for Jesus to occupy the limelight. I'm saying these three things, they're not kind of static aspects of faith that come as a big dollop at conversion. These are things we need to be growing in giving over the lordship of our lives to Jesus, growing in our sense of need of Jesus' rescue, growing in our desire for Jesus to occupy the limelight. And so let's take these three features of invalid faith, turn them round, and say, let's grow in these areas. And let's be those whose faith is becoming ever more the kind of thing that the Bible calls us to exercise. Amen.